Chapter 25. The Oregon coursed northward like a greyhound, driven by her phenomenal engines and the impatience of her crew. There was activity in nearly every section of the ship. There were five men in the armory unpacking the weapons that would be carried by Moses and Debele's men, cleaning them of cosmoline and loading hundreds of magazines. Other armorers were checking over the vessel's defensive systems, making certain that ammunition bins were fully stocked and that the salt air hadn't corroded the machine guns, gatlings, and autocannons. Down in the moon pool, technicians were inspecting the Oregon's two submersibles. Gear was being stripped out of both and extra CO2 scrubbers installed to increase the number of people each could carry. They also touched up the anechoic coating that made the two craft almost undetectable when submerged. Over the sound of their work roared an air compressor, filling dozens of scuba tanks in case they were needed. In the kitchen, every chef and assistant was on duty, preparing combat rations, while the dining staff sealed the food in airtight packages as soon as it came out of the galley. In medical, Julia Huxley and her staff were setting up the OR for an influx of casualties. Juan Cabrillo was in his customary seat in the op center, while around him his staff worked at a dizzying pace, prepping the vessel and themselves for the upcoming battle. He read over every report as it came in concerning the vessel's status. No detail was too trivial to overlook. "Max," he called without looking up from his computer monitor, "I've got something here that says the pressure in the fire suppression system is down by 15 pounds. I ordered a test trip in the hold. The system should be back up to full pressure in about an hour." "Okay. Holly, what's George's ETA?" Ali Kasim pulled down one side of his headphones. "He just took off from Cabinda, Angola, with Eric and Murph. We should be able to rendezvous in about 2.5 hours. He'll call 10 minutes out so we can slow the ship and prep the hangar." "And Tiny? Where's he?"
30,000 feet over Zambia."
Juan was relieved. The plan, like so many recently, had been hastily put together. One of the biggest obstacles was getting 100 of Moses' best men out of their refugee camp near the industrial town of Francistown, Botswana. Unlike a lot of sub-Saharan Africa, there was very little corruption in Botswana, so getting the men onto a plane without passports had been more expensive than Cabrillo would have liked. Tiny's bush pilot friend had cleared the way for them on the other end and ensured that they would have no difficulty landing in Cabinda. The Oregon would tie up to the city's main pier about 5 hours after they landed and would stay just long enough to get them aboard. From there, they would proceed north to the oil fields off the coast where Murph and Eric had detected 3 of the 10 AK-47s with the corporation's radio tags. The weapons were grouped in a swamp less than 5 miles from a massive new tanker terminal and within a 10-minute boat ride of a dozen offshore oil rigs. Juan had contacted Langston Overholt as soon as Murph had reported in. Lang had then alerted the State Department so they could issue a warning to Angola's government. However, the wheels of diplomacy turned slowly, and so far Juan's information was languishing in foggy bottom while the policy wonks hashed out a statement. Because of the low-grade civil war being waged all across Cabinda province, the petroleum companies who leased the oil fields had their own security apparatus in place. The tanker terminal and workers' compounds were fenced off and patrolled by armed guards. Cabrillo had considered calling the companies directly, but knew he would be ignored. He also knew that whatever force they had in place was a deterrent for theft and trespassing and wasn't capable of holding off an army. Any warning he did issue would likely only get more of their guards killed. Also, he had learned from Murph's aerial reconnaissance that there were hundreds of people living in shantytowns around the oil concessions. There would be far fewer civilian casualties if the fighting took place well inside the facilities. Linda Ross entered the op center with Sloane McIntyre in tow. Sloane stopped as soon as she stepped through the door. Her mouth hung a little loose as she looked around the futuristic command center. The main view screen on the forward bulkhead was split into dozens of camera angles, showing activity all around the ship, as well as a clear shot of the Oregon's bow as she powered through the sea.
Linda said I'd get a better idea of what you all do if I came with her, Sloane finally said as she approached Juan. I think I'm more confused now than I was 5 seconds ago. What is all this?
The heart and soul of the Oregon, Juan said. From here we can control the helm, the engines, communications, safety teams, as well as the ship's integrated weapon systems.
So you are with the CIA or something?
Like I told you before, I used to be. We're private citizens running a for-profit company that does freelance security work. Though I will admit the CIA has thrown us a lot of business over the years, usually with missions best left off their blackest books. Originally, our contract was to sell some arms to a group of African revolutionaries. The arms had been modified so the rebels could be tracked. Unfortunately, we were double-crossed, but we only learned about it after committing ourselves to rescue Jeffrey Merrick. So now we're back to get the weapons, only it turns out Merrick's ex-partner has other plans for them.
Who paid you to supply the guns in the first place?
It was a deal worked out between our government and the Congos. Most of the money came from the CIA. The rest was going to come from selling the blood diamonds we were given in exchange for the arms.
The diamonds you gave to Moses and Dabele for his help?
You got it.
Hey,
I guess the story wasn't so long after all, Juan quipped.
And you make a living doing this?
She asked, and then answered her own question.
Of course you do. I saw the clothes in Linda's closet. It's like Rodeo Drive in there.
Chairman, can I talk to you privately? Linda asked. Juan didn't like the tone in her voice. He got up from his chair and offered it to Sloane with a flourish.
The ship's yours.
He guided Linda to the far corner of the op center.
What's up? I was going over my interrogation notes, and while I'm not positive, I think Susan Dunleavy withheld something.
Something? Not about what Singer's attempting here. I got everything out of her about this that I could.
It's something else. I just can't put my finger on it.
It's about the timing of this whole operation, Juan stated.
It could be. I don't know.
Why would you say that? It kept me up for most of the night, he admitted. He laid out his concern. Singer's had this in motion for years, with the generators and the heaters, and suddenly he's striking at an oil facility in order to release a couple million tons of toxic sludge.
Why?
Why now? He's expecting hurricanes to carry the vapors across the Atlantic, but he can't predict when and where a storm will form.
Do you think maybe he can?
What I think is that he thinks he can.
But that's impossible.
At least with any degree of accuracy. Hurricanes grow randomly. Some never get stronger than a tropical depression and simply blow themselves out at sea.
Exactly.
And that wouldn't work for his grand demonstration.
You think he knows there's a major storm coming and that it will carry the oil vapors across the ocean?
I'll do you one better, Juan said. I think he knows the storm's track will slam it into the United States.
How could he know that?
Juan brushed a hand through his crew cut. It was the only outward sign of his frustration. That's what kept me awake. I know it's not possible for him to predict a hurricane, much less its path, but Singer's actions can only lead us to that conclusion. Even without us here, Macambo's men will eventually be overrun and the oil shut off. So Singer can't guarantee the fumes would drift far enough and remain airborne long enough to be sucked into a forming hurricane, or that if they do, that the storm wouldn't dissipate on its own. Not unless there's another element to all this we don't know about. I can try again with Susan, Linda offered. I ended the interrogation after I learned what I needed to know about the attack on the oil terminal. Juan regarded her with pride. She was giving up even more of her soul. And as much as he wanted to protect her from the toll questioning Susan Dunleavy had on her, he knew that she would have to do it again. There's something there, he said, and I know you can find it. I'll do my best. Linda turned to go. Keep me posted. 10 miles north of where Tiny Gunderson sat in his plane at the Cabinda Airport with 100 eager soldiers, Daniel Singer was talking with General Samuel Macambo of the Congolese Army of Revolution. Dawn was 2 hours away, and the jungle was finally quieting as the nocturnal insects and animals bedded down for the day. Though, with the glare of so many oil rigs burning off natural gas both offshore and along the coastline, it was a wonder how the creatures maintained their circadian rhythms. Around them in the lean-to were the most senior soldiers Macambo was willing to sacrifice for this mission. Leading the 400-man expeditionary force was Colonel Raif Abala. He was here for two reasons. Punishment for the debacle on the Congo River when he let the arms merchants get away with the diamonds, and because Macambo suspected the colonel was skimming stones from their blood diamond trade. He wouldn't be too put out if Abala didn't return. The rebels had been hiding in plain sight near the squatters' camps that had sprung up around the facility belonging to the oil giant Petromax. They wore regular, albeit ragged, clothing, and acted as though they were here seeking employment. Their weapons and outboard boats had been easily concealed in the mangroves, with guards posted nearby to dissuade fishermen or people looking for bushmeat to stray too close. Colonel, Macambo said, you know your duty. With his sheer size, Samuel Macambo was a commanding presence. And while what had once been battle-hardened muscle was slowly gelling into fat, he still possessed incredible strength. He favored mirrored sunglasses like his mentor, Idi Amin, and carried a swagger stick called a shambak made of plated hippo hide. The pistols in his twin holsters were custom-made by Beretta. Their gold inlays alone were worth a small fortune. Yes, sir, Abala replied at once. 100 men will use the boats to launch attacks on the offshore loading terminal and the rigs themselves, while the bulk of my force will concentrate on securing the compound. It's essential that you take control of the generating station as well as the pump control rooms, Dan Singer, the architect of the attack, said. And they must not be damaged. The attack on those two parts of the terminal will be carried out by my best men. They will take them as soon as we break through the perimeter fences. And your men are clear on how to work the controls? Singer demanded. Many of them were employed at this very facility until our government forbade members of our tribe from working in Congo's oil industry, Abala said. As soon as the tanker that's currently loading has been decoupled from the terminal, they know to turn the pumps on full force and dump the oil into the sea. And on the rigs? They will destroy the undersea pipes that send crude to the storage tanks on shore. Singer wished they could blow out the sides of the massive storage tanks, but they were situated in an earthen redoubt that would keep the oil contained. For the oil to properly evaporate, he needed it spread over as large an area as possible. He turned to Macambo. For every hour they hold the terminal and oil's pouring into the sea, $1 million will be automatically transferred into your Swiss bank account.
That money will go a long way to funding my revolution and improving the quality of life of our people, the guerrilla leader said with a straight face. Singer knew the lion's share of the cash would remain in Macambo's account. I made this bargain and call upon our soldiers to fight for the greater good of us all.
When searching for his mercenary force, Singer had thoroughly investigated Macambo and his Congolese Army of Revolution. They were nothing more than savage butchers who used torture and the intimidation of defenseless civilians to keep themselves supplied. While there was a tribal element to the conflict, human rights groups estimated that the CAR had killed more of their own people than the government they opposed. Macambo was just another example of the despotic nature of African politics.
"Very well," Singer said. "Then it's time for me to leave."
He had planned on leaving Cabinda a day before the attack, but he'd remained as long as he dared, hoping against hope that he'd get word from Nina Visser. She and the others hadn't been at the rendezvous site when the plane arrived, although tire tracks next to the runway indicated someone had been there recently. The pilot managed to follow them from the air, but only for a couple of miles. The relentless wind had scoured the desert floor. He'd circled the area until he had just enough fuel to return to Windhoek, failing to find any sign of them. Singer had ordered him back to Cabinda so they could fly to the port city of Nouakchott, Mauritania, where the aged 100,000-ton tanker he'd secretly purchased from a Libyan company waited. She was named the Gulf of Sidra and had spent her career plying the Mediterranean, ferrying Libyan oil to Yugoslavia and Albania. When he'd toured her with Susan Dunleavy, she said the vessel's tanks would make perfect incubators for her organic flocculant. The marine engineering firm Singer hired to inspect the ship signed off on her hull being able to withstand a sustained thermal load of 140 degrees, although they said in their report they were unaware of any oil terminals in the world where crude retained that much of the Earth's heat. Singer had closed the deal, obtained a Liberian registration for the ship, by far the easiest to get in the world, and hadn't bothered to change her name. Susan had then overseen the initial seeding of her heat-generating goo and had checked in on it from time to time before her abduction. Her reports showed that everything was working perfectly, so Singer knew she didn't need to be there when he released it. Still, something could come up that might require her expertise. The loss of Nina and her group was of little concern. He just wished Susan was with him. The flocculant had been her brainchild, and when she'd contacted him about her discovery and its potential application, she had wanted to be a part of the final act. And then there was Merrick. Singer had so wanted to see his smug face collapse when he witnessed the creation of the most destructive hurricane ever to hit the United States and realized he and polluters like him were at fault. Singer had told Merrick of his plan, so he was left with the hope his former partner was still alive and would know the truth about what was transpiring. Because of the specialized nature of running a supertanker, he couldn't rely on a bunch of long-haired environmentalists, so he'd been forced to hire a professional crew, men whose silence could be bought. The captain was a Greek alcoholic who'd lost his master's license after running a tanker aground in the Persian Gulf. The chief engineer was another Greek who couldn't stay away from the bottle. He hadn't worked since a steam pipe explosion in an engine room had killed four of his assistants. A board of inquiry cleared him, but rumors of negligence ruined his career. Those two made the rest of the crew look like saints.
"You'll make your attack at dawn?" Singer asked. "Yes. You have more than enough time to get to your plane," Macambo said with a hint of derision.
not that he was going to be here for the fight. He had a fast boat waiting to whisk him down the coast and back up the Congo River. Singer let his tone pass. He stood.
Remember, every hour is $1 million.
If your men can hold off the security forces and Angola's police when they get organized for 48 hours, I'll throw in a $5 million bonus. He was looking at Abala. And another 5 for you, Colonel. Then cry havoc, Makambo said, using his favorite quote, and let slip the dogs of war.